Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is August the 7th, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment to Hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Surprise! Facebook let advertisers have your phone number. It didn't surprise you, did it? Did you trust Facebook with your phone number? That might not have been the smartest move. The Federal Trade Commission is about to file a complaint that suggests Facebook misled its users about how their phone numbers would be handled. You may have uploaded your phone number as part of the two-factor authentication, but the Federal Trade Commission says advertisers use those numbers to target you without your knowledge. The feds are also attacking Facebook for not clearly explaining that users could turn off a facial recognition tool often used for tagging photos. Allegedly, 30 million users were left in the dark about that setting. This news comes as the government ripped Facebook with a $5 billion fine, although reports says the original fine was supposed to be much higher. Well, I also think it should be much higher. Like, how about the entire profits for 1 year? So will Facebook ever learn, or are we doomed to report those constant data leaks every single day? According to the Washington Post, Facebook is agreeing to submit to unprecedented federal oversight of its business practices, including the creation of a special committee on its board of directors that regularly certifies the tech giant is handling user data appropriately. Somehow, we don't think this is the end of Facebook's privacy scandals. Whistleblower claims Siri recordings are regularly sent to Apple contractors for analysis. Apple has joined the dubious company of Google and Amazon in secretly sharing with contractors audio recordings of its users. A whistleblower at Apple said that Siri queries are routinely sent to human listeners for closer analysis, something not disclosed in Apple's privacy policy. The recordings are reported not associated with an Apple ID, but can be several seconds long, include content of a personal nature, and are match up with other revealing data like location, app data, and contact details. Like the other companies, Apple says this data is collected and analyzed by humans to improve its services, and that all analysis is done in a secure facility by workers found by workers' confidentiality agreements. Apple said that less than 1% of the daily queries are sent. That's called comfort when the company is also constantly talking up the volume of Siri queries. Hundreds of millions of devices use the feature regularly, making a conservative estimate of a fraction of 1% rise quickly into the hundreds of thousands. The small portion of Siri requests is apparently randomly chosen, and as the whistleblower notes, it includes countless instances of recordings featuring private discussions between doctors and patients, business details, seemingly criminal dealings, and sexual encounters, and so on. Some of these activations of Siri will have been accidental, which is one of the things listeners are trained to listen for and identify. Accidentally recorded queries can be many seconds long and contain a great deal of personal information, even if it's not directly led to a digital identity. Only in the last month has it come out that Google likewise sent clips to be analyzed, and that Amazon, which we knew recorded Alexa queries, retains that audio indefinitely. Apple may collect and store details of how you use the services, including search queries. This information may be used to improve the relevancy of results provided by the services, except in limited instances to ensure quality of services over the internet. Such information, they say, will not be associated with your IP address. It's conceivable that the phrase search queries is inclusive of recordings of search queries, and it does say that it shares some data with third parties. But nowhere is it stated simply that questions you ask your phone may be recorded and shared with a stranger. Nor is there any way for users to opt out of this practice. Given Apple's focus on privacy and transparency, it is not meeting the standard that they've set for privacy. TV networks sue nonprofit to kill free TV service. Have you ever heard of that? Well, Locast is an AT&T-funded nonprofit that retransmit local TV over the internet. In other words, they take the over-the-air signal and they rebroadcast it so that it can be seen on the internet. The major broadcast networks today sue the makers of Locast, that's L-O-C-A-S-T if you want to look it up, a nonprofit organization that provides free online access to broadcast TV stations. The lawsuit filed by ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC seeks financial damages and a permanent injunction that would shut Locast down. Broadcast TV networks are available for free over the air with an antenna, but selling the rights to retransmit those signals in other ways is a big business. Broadcasters reportedly collect $10.1 billion last year via retransmission fees that they charge cable and satellite TV companies. TV providers routinely pass this cost along to consumers in the form of broadcast TV fees. Pay TV providers use these fees to raise the actual cost of service above the advertised prices and to raise customers' prices even while they're under contract. Pay TV providers have also been refusing the broadcasters' demands to pay even higher fees, and broadcast channels have frequently been blacked out on cable and satellite TV systems as a result. Well, you can receive these over-the-air channels very easily by using an antenna or Locast. Well, what is Locast? TV subscribers can deal with blackouts by using an antenna or a service like Locast. While Locast is a nonprofit, the broadcasters argue that it's actually bankrolled by the satellite TV industry, DirecTV owner AT&T notably donating $500,000 to Locast, and Locast founder has ties to Dish Network. Locast said it is on a mission to help TV viewers get easier access to channels that are supposedly to be free. Ever since the dawn of TV broadcasting in the mid-20th century, nonprofit organizations have provided translator TV stations as a public service, where a primary broadcaster cannot reach a receiver with a strong enough signal. The translator amplifies that signal with another transmitter, allowing consumers who otherwise could not get the over-the-air signal to receive important programming, including local news, weather, and of course, sports. Locast.org provides the same public service, except instead of an over-the-air signal transmitter, they use a local broadcast signal via online streaming onto the internet. So far, Locast is available in 13 U.S. markets, namely Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Houston, Philadelphia, Rapid City, South Dakota, Los Angeles, New York City, San Francisco, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Washington, D.C. Locast intends to expand to new markets but solicits donations because it says it has considerable costs for equipment, bandwidth, and operational support. Well, isn't that the definition of a nonprofit? They depend on donations. Locast can be used on mobile devices, streaming boxes, and web browsers. It detects your location and lets you choose from a selection of local TV channels. Networks claim Locast isn't really a nonprofit. Broadcasters fear that wider availability of free TV channels will make it harder to charge retransmission fees to cable and satellite companies. The networks filed their lawsuit in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York against Sports Fan Coalition. The founder is David Goodfriend and the New York chapter of this group, which created Locast. Goodfriend, an attorney and lobbyist, has been fighting TV blackouts for years on multiple fronts. The lawsuit filed by ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC says plaintiffs, including their affiliated companies, collectively invest billions of dollars to create, acquire, and provide valuable television programming. That programming is broadcast to the public for free over-the-air viewing. But the overwhelming majority of households have elected the convenience and reliability of viewing plaintiffs' copyrighted programming through services offered by cable, satellite, broadband, and mobile providers. By virtue of several acts of Congress, those providers must have a license to retransmit copyrighted television programming, notwithstanding that the programming is broadcast over the air by plaintiffs and their local affiliates, and must also secure the consent of the broadcasters to retransmit the broadcast signals. Even though the TV channels are available for free, Locast can't retransmit them, the lawsuit said. Locast captures over-the-air broadcast signals, strips critical data from those signals, and then retransmits those signals and the copyrighted content that they carry to register users over the internet. The catch is, unlike licensed cable, satellite, and streaming services, Locast neither obtains plaintiff's permission nor pays for its exploitation of plaintiff's exclusive rights to publicly perform their copyrighted content. Instead, Locast simply takes plaintiff's copyrighted content and retransmits it to its registered users at will over the internet. The broadcasters acknowledge that a 1976 copyrighted law allows, in other words, it does allow nonprofits to boost local broadcast signals. But they argue that Locast is nothing like the local booster services contemplated by Congress in creating this narrow exemption. In reality, the networks, the lawsuit says, that Locast's founding funding, in other words, the initial seed money of $500,000, and operations reveal its decidedly commercial purposes. To prove that Locast has commercial purposes, the lawsuit points to AT&T's $500,000 donation and the fact that Goodfriend is a paid lobbyist for Dish. AT&T and Dish have both fought broadcasters over retransmission fees leading to blackouts. The lawsuit says these two for-profit businesses, which is AT&T and Dish Network, provide Locast with valuable nationwide distribution of the Locast app on the internet connected set-top boxes of their subscribers. At the same time, Locast provides these two major distributors with commercial benefits that include the ability to A. Avoid obtaining retransmission consent from local stations to include local stations in their pay TV offerings by integrating the Locast app into their customer set-top boxes, and B. to gain leverage in negotiations with broadcast stations over retransmission consent rights to offer their subscribers access to broadcast channels, and C, for Dish Network to promote a version of its Sling TV internet television service that does not carry local broadcast channels by telling potential customers that they can supplement Sling TV by getting the broadcast channels via Locast. Locast is not the non-commercial community public service it purports to be. It is strategic play funded by and functioning for the benefit of decidedly commercial interests. AT&T released a statement saying that Locast offers consumers an innovative new way to access free over-the-air signals. They said that they support technologies that give consumers more choices and better access to this local content. Well, the founders are ready for a legal fight. Will that argument convince a judge or jury? Goodfriend was eager to find out even before he got sued, according to the New York Times. According to Locast, they are operating under parameters that are designed to be compliant with the law. Glidefriend also told the Times that he tried to get funding from DISH chairman but was unable to. Glidefriend wasn't drawing a salary from Locast and has taken out a loan to fund the operation, which cost more than $700,000 as of January. According to the New York Times, the AT&T donation came several months later. The broadcasters are in a bind here because they could have argued that Locast is a cable system, but they pushed to shoot down that argument back when Aereo, A-E-R-E-O, made it after losing on fair use in the Supreme Court. Basically, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They don't want an internet-based system to be able to pay for retransmission as a cable system, but that opens up the possibility that a nonprofit organization like Locast can be eligible for this exemption. Proving that Locast violates the copyright law, the nonprofit exemption would be hard, but maybe impossible. The complaint made some extremely incoherent arguments about Locast somehow gaining commercial advantage as a nonprofit. You can't rule out the chance of broadcasters succeeding in their argument that Locast ties to AT&T and DISH Network undermines its nonprofit status. But there are many profit-making organizations like Con Ed that donates to nonprofits, so I don't see where there's a problem there. But winning on that point could be a Pyrrhic victory because it wouldn't stop future services from providing the same service that Locast does. Locast funding is a complicated issue that I'm not quite sure how it's all going to come down to, but the best that does for broadcasters is to stop Locast specifically and create a blueprint for another nonprofit to step up and do the same thing. Aside from the funding question, the plain language of the statute seems to support a nonprofit retransmitting TV signals over the internet. The secondary transmission of a performance or display of a work embodied in a primary transmission is not an infringement of copyright. If the secondary retransmission is not made by a cable system, but is made by a government body or other nonprofit organization. To qualify for that exemption, the law says an organization must not have any purpose or direct or indirect commercial advantage. The broadcaster's argument is that Locast is a front for AT&T and DISH Network and thus would be a problem for Locast. It can't provide a convincing counter-argument. But remember, the $500,000 that AT&T made was after Locast had started operation, so you can't just really say that this all started with AT&T. But other parts of the statute are probably easy for Locast to satisfy. The statute says retransmission must be made without charge to the recipients of the secondary transmission other than assessments necessary to defray the actual and reasonable cost of operating the secondary transmission service. While Locast solicits donations, it isn't charging users for its service, so it would not run afoul of that provision. Locast isn't the only threat to broadcast networks' retransmission fees. A bipartisan bill that was filed in the House seeks to end the current retransmission consent system and allow free market contract negotiations to happen under traditional copyright law. You know what? This whole thing is going to wind up in the Supreme Court a couple years from now, and then we'll find out. Amazon seeks distribution hub in Queens. The company is reportedly checking out an industrial site in Maspeth. Amazon may have bowed out from bringing its second East Coast headquarters to Long Island City, but the e-commerce company is still reportedly looking into beefing up its New York presence. Less than a week after reports surfaced that the tech giant may be seeking close to 1 million square feet of distribution space in Brooklyn Industrial City, Cranes reports that the company is also considering building a ground-up distribution facility in Maspeth, Queens. Citing sources familiar with the firm's real estate plans, Cranes says the company is eyeing an industrial site at 55-15 Grand Avenue between Newtown Creek and Rust Street near 56th Road for a new warehouse space covering over 700,000 square feet. The property was purchased by RXR Realty and LBA Realty last year for $72 million, and it's already being cleared to make way for potential new development. A spokesperson for Amazon declined to comment on the Maspeth or Industrial City deals, but if both come to pass, the e-commerce giant will have major hubs in all of the outer boroughs. The company already operates a more than 850,000 square feet of a fulfillment center in Staten Island, located on the borough's western shore, and it also plans to open a little more than 120,000 square foot distribution center in Hunts Point in the South Bronx. The company is also reportedly seeking office space in Midtown West and at the former Lord & Taylor building that houses its flagship store on Fifth Avenue. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell in his continuing IT Pro series, Backing Up Your Systems.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and some of the different things that we as IT professionals handle and tackle, well, you need to be aware of them too. One of the big things that I have latched on to for years, this is something that's a passion of mine, and that is making sure that we have data backups. Okay, if you don't have a data backup, you're in trouble. If your company doesn't have a data backup and they don't know how to get on to that disaster recovery right away, there's problems. There's a set of statistics out, and it's updated on a regular basis. Initially, it was a matter of if you went 7 days without access to your computer systems, that your chances of surviving were 50-50. Now, what do I mean by surviving? That means within a year, your company would be out of business. It takes a while for a company to devolve to that set and point in time where everything's wrong and it just self-implodes. The latest on this, 90% of businesses that go without data, without their servers, for 1 week will be out of business within a year. Data backups are important. Every business should do a data backup. Every business should have a business continuity plan, BCP. They should have a data recovery plan. That's a DR plan. There's also disaster recovery plan. And you know what? Every business out there, they say they have a plan for that. But the reality is they don't audit that. They don't test that. They don't compare it up to reality. They don't work through any of the different ideas of what could go wrong. Oh, yeah, we've got that tape machine over in the corner, and we back up everything every night, and it's fine. No, you actually have to go through, and you have to, A, have a distinct, well-planned-out, robust plan. You need to also go through on a regular basis and test every single one of the parts of that plan. One of the things that I put together years ago, and I've done this for somewhere around a half dozen companies, and this is just something that I've done sometimes as a primary, sometimes as a consultant, and sometimes as a secondary person just reviewing the data. But I've gone through and I've made sure that the business continuity plans, the disaster recovery plans, the data recovery plans were all robust. And when we talk about robust, we talk about different areas that most people don't think about. Yeah, my plan is I'm going to just spin up that computer over there and we're going to put the tape in and we're going to recover it. No, you should be doing a test of that tape backup every month. Yes, every month you should be able to recover a good portion of data. I usually say try to recover about a half terabyte of data. That's a lot of data for some people, a lot of data for some companies. That's a small amount for other companies. Another good guideline, if you're uncomfortable with that, 10%. 10% or 1 terabyte, whichever is smaller. You know, we want to go through, we want to make sure that you're doing that. But one of the other things that I have also set in place is that I also make sure that we can source all of the different hardware that's needed to bring the company back online. What happens if the company burns down? The building burns down, okay? All of the computers are gone. You have a tape backup that's off-site. This is a regular thing. You have to have an off-site tape backup. What do? Well, you can actually recover the company's data to another server, but you have to have that server. You have to know where to buy that server. You have to know, hey, XYZ company, they're a great value-added reseller, VAR. They provide servers and tape backup or devices, which are also tape recovery devices, and they provide the hardware, all of the hardware we're going to need. We need to be able to source that immediately. And you have a pre-written out. This is one of the things I actually did. I pre-wrote a purchase order for all of the hardware we would need if the company burned down. So I knew exactly what items I would need and what items I could deal as a replacement for. For instance, you don't necessarily need the exact server that you have in the rack. Okay, so we've got a big rack filled with servers and hard drives and the rest of it. You don't have to have the exact server, but you have to have a server. You have to have a recent server with the right amount of memory, the right amount of CPU power. You have to be able to put this all together. You have to be able to handle this. What do we do about your home systems? Do you do a backup? If you don't do a backup, go on out right now. Buy yourself at one of those. You can get a 4 terabyte. You can get a 6 terabyte hard drive at Walmart for a little over $100. By all means, have one of those. Just back up everything that's on your hard drive to that. If you've got multiple hard drives, back them all up to that one hard drive and take that hard drive and you make sure that it's not connected up to your computer. You make sure that it sits in, you know, if you've got a fire safe at home, great. You've got a safety deposit box someplace other than your home. If you've got multiple drives, you want to really do this right. Basically, you get 2 of those drives, $200 of investment. Do you know how much it costs to recover your hard drive? Let's say you've got a 1 terabyte hard drive. It just crashes and you send it to a data recovery place. $1,000, basically, minimum. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Windows 7. Hospitals and healthcare aren't ready to say goodbye to it yet. The world can safely look at 2017's WannaCry outbreak through the rearview mirror, but the impending cutoff date for Windows 7 patches could set the stage for a repeat in a healthcare sector that depends on machines that can't be upgraded. Windows 10 was initially released in 2015. Windows 10 now accounts for 66% of PCs in the installed base, compared to 29% for Windows 7. Do the quick math. That's 95% of the installed base of PCs. Things get murky when looking at Windows 10 adoption in specific industries. IT systems were impacted by the file encrypting WannaCry malware largely due to organizations running a significant number of older Windows machines that were exposed to an attack that didn't affect Windows 10 at all. The situation was so severe that Microsoft issued patches for Windows XP, which it stopped shipping security updates for in 2014. Almost 2 years to the date of WannaCry, Microsoft again is offering patches for XP because of an eerily similar and equally wormable bug called Bluekeep. The healthcare sector is the most Windows-dominated industry of all, with just over half of all endpoints running legacy Windows, amounting to over 500,000 of devices. The healthcare sector might be able to move many PCs to the latest version of Windows, but they also maintain legions of diverse machines that simply can't keep up with all the PC upgrade cycles. There are some vertical applications that have been moving more promptly to Windows 10 than others. The long lag time for Windows upgrades at the healthcare sector in the United States and the United Kingdom, and likely all the nations face, could spell trouble for healthcare organizations that can't, for legitimate technical and business reasons, keep pace with a broader shift to Windows 10. And the reason many healthcare organizations do not upgrade is because of business-specific applications, which also happens to support life-saving functions that, in many cases, don't have redundancy processes built around downtime for OS upgrades. For the ones who are not moving off Windows 7, such as healthcare, there could be a number of reasons why they don't. Some reasons include being dependent on third-party applications that don't support Windows 10. The process for migrating operating systems is very disruptive. Whether the shift to Windows 10 from Windows 7 plays out as a repeat of what happened with Windows XP remains to be seen. Internet Explorer is less of an issue today than it was when XP was retired, but Windows 7 is the closest version of Windows to XP in terms of reliability and usage. Windows XP was built into so many kiosks and medical equipment devices and so on, it still can't get off of Windows XP. You think about a CAT scanner running Windows XP. XP was very sturdy and resilient operating system, and a CAT scanner is not built to adopt a new operating system. You expect to hold on to that CAT scanner for many years because it costs millions of dollars to buy. That's why Microsoft offered a patch for Windows XP. And then there's Windows XP in ATMs. It would cost so much money to migrate that it's not necessarily an option for smaller banks. We have a crisis in upgrading operating systems. Have you ever wondered where all those Amazon returns go? With a couple $100 and a few minutes, you could go to a liquidation website right now and buy a pallet full of stuff that people have returned to Amazon. It will have perhaps been lightly sorted by product category, and every box is a core sample drilled through the digital crust of platform capitalism. On Amazon's website, sophisticated sorting algorithms relentlessly rank and organize these products before they go out into the world. But once the goods return to the warehouse, they shake free of the database and become random objects thrown together into a box by fate. Most likely, never will this precise box of things thrown together ever exist again in the world. On liquidation.com, each pallet's manifest comes with suggested prices for each product in a pristine state. If you add them up, the value of the box might be $4,000, while the auction price might be only $200. While Amazon doesn't publicly talk about how it chooses which return products go back up for sale and which go to the liquidators, it does sell some products through Amazon Warehouse at a discount. If it sounds crazy to sell products at massive discounts, consider that goods sitting in a warehouse are a cost. So is the labor necessary to repackage something for resale. If Amazon and other retailers let another company pay for something, they avoid those costs and add some revenue. So Liquidity Services, the operator of liquidation.com, became a major, though not exclusive, handler of Amazon's American liquidation. The company calls dealing with returns the reverse supply chain. A part of the retail business has been growing in importance as online shopping becomes more popular. Liquidity Services now has 3.4 million registered buyers on its various liquidation websites. In the past fiscal year, it sold $625 million worth of stuff. Amazon represents a growing chunk of Liquidity's business. In its most recent Securities Exchange Commission filing, the company disclosed that it spent approximately $38 million on Amazon's liquidation inventory, which it then turns around and sells for maybe 5% of the supposed retail value. And assuming the company's trying to turn a profit, it must buy the inventory for a fraction of that. Doing the rough math, we're talking about inventory that once had a collective value reaching into the billions before it lands in some box on the doorstep. Of course, once people do buy these unwanted goods, they rearrange them into more profitable configurations. It seems so easy. Sort the still good stuff from the broken objects, the trash, the worthless, and then post that stuff to Amazon or eBay, who couldn't sell $4,000 worth of stuff for more than $200. There's a difference between something having a suggested retail value of $40 and actually getting someone to pay you $40 for it. The exchange value of most of these items is incredibly low outside the retail context in which they were purchased. A liquidation reseller offered some realistic assessments. He had a couple of following rules. The first is, don't expect it all to be good. Don't get discouraged if you're halfway through your pallet and it's all trash. It's typical to throw away a third to half of everything. With electronics, it could be a boom or bust. Then you have to consider shipping, remember freight costs, and what sales strategy you're going to use. Speed through your inventory and don't try to squeeze it for every dollar. And don't invest money that you absolutely need. It isn't like a savings account at your bank. You're taking a risk. Consider the bad things that can happen, not merely the potential profits. You're going to see a bunch of videos about people making a bunch of money on pallets. But just keep in mind that, just like everything else in social media, you're probably only seeing the top 10, 5% of what they do. No one brags about their losses. What to do when your Windows operating system misbehaves? Some users have been experiencing problems running with Windows 10 after a Windows update. One possible cause is a communication transmission error during the Windows update process. Another possible cause is a rolling electrical brownout resulting in low operating voltage, causing a loss or corruption of data. I normally recommend rolling back the operating system to a point prior to the Windows update and go through the Windows update again. Why not just skip the system restore and do the Windows update again? The Windows update may have corrupted other parts of the operating system outside of the Windows update. Before you do a systems restore, check that the power options have been properly set. The turn off display option should be set to never, and the put to sleep option should be set to never. You don't want to interrupt the system restore process at any point in time. System restore is a recovery tool for Windows that allows you to reverse certain kinds of changes made to the operating system. System restore is used to return important Windows files and settings like drivers, registry keys, system files, installed programs, and more back to previous versions and settings. Restoring your computer to a previous state only affects the Windows files. It's that type of data normally to blame for issues that would prompt you to use system restore. If strange things are happening to your computer after a driver install, for example, you might find that restoring the system to a previous state before the driver install fixes the problem because system restore will undo the installation. As another example, say you're restoring your computer to the state it was in a week ago. Any programs you've installed during that time will be uninstalled during the system restore. It's important to understand that this is so you're not left thinking that your computer is in an even worse state when you discover that a program or two are missing after the restore. In the system restore process, your data is untouched. After the system restore, remember to reset the power options to its original settings. Continuing with home automation by Marty Winston, Pipe Dreams and Nightmares. You might think of plumbing pipes as a pretty low-tech topic, but Marty Winston tells what he knows about plumbing woes, how to retrofit what you have to waste less, cost less, and break less. It's all pipe dreams versus nightmares for Marty. Hey, Marty, let me hear your nightmares.
If I tell you that pipes leak, what's the first thing you think of? Probably water, right? That's a worthwhile priority since water leaks can cause a lot of very expensive damage. We can get into that. But water leaks are occasional. They tend not to happen all the time. When they do, you or your plumber deal with them. Or if it's something major like a burst hose on the clothes washer, you may also call in contractors and your insurance company. But there's something else that's leaking from your pipes every day, and it too has real-world consequences. Over time, maybe as much as or more than water leaks. I'll get into that, too. Some of it is about prevention, some of it is about triage. All of it is about pipes. It's likely that pipes first showed up in ancient public baths, and many early pipes were made from things like clay or ceramics or bamboo. Pipes evolved, and for a time, most were made with lead or iron. Modern plumbing pipes are generally copper or brass or plastic. Some are hard plastic and some are more flexible, more like what you might think of as hoses. There may seem to be a lot of pipes running in and around your house, so let's simplify. Every home plumbing system starts with just one pipe, either a connection to a water main, city water main, for example, or a connection to a well pump. What happens next can vary. Certainly, at some point, there's an early feed to a hot water heater, and hot water pipes will be companions to cold water pipes on most runs. Before that, though, many homes will route some of the source water directly to things like outdoor watering spigots. The rest may go through filters or softeners or other treatment devices. Sometimes the conditioned water line sees yet another split to a more thorough water purifier, which then feeds cooking and drinking water, maybe with a special secondary faucet at the sink, maybe with a line to the refrigerator, maybe with a direct connection to a coffee maker. Think of it this way. There's the source water, either city water or well water. There's yard water, which is just about the same. There's whole house conditioned water, sometimes called washing water. It feeds showers and clothes washers and dishwashers and toilets and utility sinks and bathroom faucets. There may also be purified water, sometimes called cooking and drinking water. How much conditioning or treatment or purification happens will depend on the quality of the source water and on the preferences of the homeowner. I'm going through this because it can help explain why, in some houses, piping can get really complicated. But that's not the only reason. For a moment, imagine that the pipes are roadways from the source water to each and every endpoint. All those faucets and toilets and appliances and fixtures are the endpoints. There are two basic choices when laying out those water roads. You can either have roads lead to junctions that split off into other roads, or you can do all the splitting off right at the beginning and make every road an uninterrupted direct run all the way to the endpoint. The first way is called trunking. The second way is called home runs. The chances are your house is doing it the first way, trunking, with pipes feeding junctions and lines branching off from there. For example, there may be one run to the master bathroom. Okay, really two, one for hot and one for cold. When it gets nearby, the main feeder run may branch off into the separate pipes that reach, stand by for a list here, the bathtub, the shower, the jacuzzi, the his sink, the hers sink, and the toilet. On the one hand, that approach lets the feeder pipe do the heavy lifting and you're running just one pipe there instead of as many as six, each, hot and cold. On the other hand, junctions are by far the most likely places for plumbing to leak. That's important enough for me to repeat. Junctions are the most likely places for plumbing to leak. Now, just as an aside for future reference, General Motors did exhaustive testing half a century ago that shows that electrical connections, in a sense, wiring junction points, are the most likely cause of failure for electrical devices. Let's make that a bumper sticker. You can't say junction without saying junk. Running feeders to downpath junction points can also make repairs a little more difficult since those junctions are often inside hard-to-reach places. I won't be talking about ventilation systems today, but I will point out that the layout of most vents is similar to this kind of feeder setup. It resembles a tree with a big trunk connecting to not quite as big major limbs that in turn connect to smaller branches. That's trunking. Most vents use it. Most pipes use it. But there's one newer alternative to trunking that you'll want to know about. Instead of splitting off at the other end of feeder lines, it does all its branching near the beginning, using a big block with a lot of water connections on it, each with its own small shutoff valve. That's called a manifold. In a way, it does for water what a circuit breaker box does for electricity. It gives you a way to selectively shut down any troubled water line all from a single central point. Ideally, it makes what's called a home run connection to each individual endpoint and has separate sets of connections for hot water and cold water runs. Catch that? No junctions. It eliminates those frequent failure points. And ideally, it feeds a PEX pipe, that kind of soft plastic flexible pipe that somewhat resembles a hose but that can handle extreme pressures. There's more. Water flowing through hard pipes is usually audible. You can hear when it's flowing. Water in PEX pipes is much less audible, much quieter. Also, hard pipes passing through humid parts of the house can sweat, meaning moisture in the air turns into dripping water, and damage from that is possible. There is much less of that with PEX. But there's a more malignant issue with hard pipes, and a lot more so than with PEX. And you can apply the same cure to either kind. Remember, I said there are two kinds of leakage that happen with plumbing. One kind is water. The other kind is thermal, and it's costing you more than you think. Let's start with the hot water pipes. They leave the water heater at whatever temperature you set it to deliver, often 120 degrees Fahrenheit, give or take. How far along the pipe do you think it's still 120 degrees? And for how long? Or to put it another way, when you turn on the hot water, how long do you have to wait before hot water comes out? When you do all the math, you may be surprised to learn that you typically run through gallons of water before the water you get is as hot as it's going to get. That's gallons of water you heated once that's since cooled off just sitting in the pipes. And when you turn off the hot water, there are gallons of freshly heated water remaining in the pipe that are already starting to cool. It isn't just that you paid to heat all that water and the energy is going to waste. Yes, a waste of energy is a waste of money. Also, it's a waste of your time, but that's not all. All the while the hot water is flowing, and even for a while after the flow of hot water stops, that length of pipe is working like a heater and radiating heat into the house. That little bit of extra heat is also a little bit of extra work for your air conditioning. Are you keeping a tally? So far, you're wasting water, wasting energy, wasting your time as you wait for the hot water, making your hot water heater work longer and making your air conditioner work longer and a little harder. Which also means your hot water heater and your air conditioner are going to need expensive repairs or replacement just a little bit sooner than necessary. And flip that upside down for your cold water pipes. It's not so much waiting for the water to get cold, but it is stealing a little heat from your house during the winter heating season. And during the summer, since the tap water is less than chilly, your ice maker will have to work a little harder. I can't really speak to the temperature of water coming through city water mains, but I can tell you that for most of the country, well water comes out of the ground at temperatures in the 40s or 50s, crisp and cool. I've said before that the very best way to cut how much you spend on things like electricity, gas, and water is to cut how much you're losing, and it's both easy and inexpensive to do that for thermal losses in your water delivery. All you need to do is to add insulation to the pipes. A lot of you can do it yourself, but in any case, plumbers are happy to take on the task. For my product reviews, I just got in Tubolit pipe insulation from Armacell. Tubolit is T-U-B-O-L-I-T. And Armacell is A-R-M-A-C-E-L-L. This is economy-priced tubular insulation, closed-cell polyethylene insulation. It's pre-slit, so it's really fast and easy to wrap around either hard pipe or PEX. It's an effective thermal insulator and also helps reduce the noise of water going through the pipes. A peace and quiet you don't know you're missing until you do. So, let's say your hot water heater is set for 120 degrees. Go to the farthest hot water faucet in your house and turn it on until the water is as hot as it's going to get. If you have insulated pipes, that should be right around 118 degrees. Turn the water off, wait an hour, come back to the faucet, and oh, this floors me. It will still be somewhere in the 105 to 110 degree range. It hasn't lost much at all. Now that's what I call a pipe dream. Next time, not much a noise like noise. And some of it comes through the walls from the room next to yours. I'll explain how a wall can act like the cone of a speaker and send sound straight through from its other side, and how some leading wallboard manufacturers found a clever way to stop the noise halfway through the wall.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings, and if you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on building blocks to set up a computer network. I'll be giving the presentation if you want to hear it. Thursday, August the 8th, meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on the future of Windows, Thursday, August the 22nd, 2019, and the meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They meet in the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, September the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PCs Users Group meets on Thursday, September the 5th at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. The meeting time is at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing meets Tuesday, September the 10th at 2 p.m., and the meeting location is Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There's no such thing as a dumb question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.